Okay, good guys. Good morning, you guys. Good evening. With a late start, I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and this time we're going to start the technet a little late because of technical difficulties. Main purpose of the technet, you guys have heard me say it a zillion times, is education. Curious radio amateurs gather at this time for the last 34 and a half years and discuss their favorite subject, wireless equipment, and how to understand it, how to make it work better. This will be TechNet number 1689. A little later on, you'll hear Space Report number 289. And before that, you're going to hear Science and Physics Report number 19. They officially began on October 8th. That's when Roy first signed in with a real website and whatever. And ever since then, we've been conducting Science and Physics Reports. A person signs into the TechNet by giving this group of guys your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in if you're just listening. After 34 and a half years, we believe somebody is listening. According to what Eric just told us, for the first time in a couple of weeks, we now have linking to the 147.375 machine, and they're now connected to the 85 machine, so that link is working. Possibly IRLP is working, but EchoLink may not be working yet. Okay, so we have any check-ins, give me a call letters and name right now. Do wait for the beeps. K2RY, are you listening?
W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
We got Joe. Anyone else?
And WS2N, Paul, is out here with the space report.
Good evening, Dick.
Hi, Joe.
Bet you that's going to be space report number 289. Okay. One more call, at least. Anyone else to sign in? Because you do have a question or a comment for the TechNet. Please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
K2FIU, antenna question.
Okay, we got you, George. And antenna questions are not the ones that we handle. That's a joke. My favorite subject. Okay, we've got Joe and George. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW.
K2RIW, Dick.
K2RIW,
Dick.
Okay, we got Rich and 2EO, so we got Joe, George, Rich. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW. Okay, we're going to start off with Joe, W2RYY. How are those electrons treating you in your neighborhood? Those photons, those RF photons, Joe, W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, I got good audio here. Well, goes in one radio, comes out of the other. Okay. I did some experiments with that antenna I have, the folded monopole for 6 meters. I did some tests out in the fence, and I want to find out if I do some changes to if I can increase the bandwidth of the antenna.
Okay, the subject matter is monopole and increasing the bandwidth. Go right ahead with your question.
Okay, let's see here. I wrote all this stuff down here. The antenna seems to be resonant best at 52.600. That's pretty much where I remember cutting it when I did this test with a network analyzer about 15 years ago, actually. It takes a little time to get into these things, you know. You know how it is, Dick. I won't give you all the points. I'll just give you the minus 10 dB points. So that gives you some idea of the bandwidth of the antenna that I have currently. It was tested about maybe 8 feet off the ground. So I figure that's, you know, not too bad. Not as well what I'm going to get up on the roof. But, you know, it gives me some sort of approximation. 52.6, I got a return loss of minus 24. That was red. It's about 130 feet of half inch heliax, which has about 0.7 dB loss one way. Because I wanted to actually just get realize your system performance on the end of a transmission cable, not just measured by the antenna itself. Minus 10 dB at 51.12 and 54.36. I wanted to see if I can get the antenna a little more wider than that, so maybe it'll cover down as low as almost maybe 50 megahertz without too much return loss. This antenna has a top element that's folded over, but the thickness of the... I remember to let go of the buttons, I don't time the thing out. I mean, TOT's set correctly here. The top element of this antenna is not the same diameter completely, you know, from one end to the other. It's about 3/8 inch aluminum tube, not tubing, but like a solid piece that looks like, you know, that comes from the top and goes over to the ground. But the actual radiating part, I guess you, what you'd call it, looks like it's almost 3/4 inch in diameter. And my question is, how much more bandwidth would I get if I actually attach a pipe or piece of maybe aluminum tubing about the same diameter as that initial 3/4 inch tubing, like the same approximate length? Do you think that would double bandwidth, or does that not really work in a linear fashion? Back to you.
Yeah, the best way I can give you an answer is by way of the real measurements that were made on the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. And they're available on the two websites of Mike number one, KC2NJI, that's on Landmark, let's see now, amateurradio.tangovictor. If you go to amateurradio.tangovictor, that's Mike number one. Go to Mike number two, K1MJM, which is bymarktechnet.com. In either of those places, you'll find the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. Now, these are measurements that were made for a quarter-wave ground plane, very large ground plane, and a whole series of various diameters. So you can look at how fast the resistive component changes, which is very slow as a function of diameter, and how fast the reactive component changes as a function of diameter when you're tuning off resonance. So by looking at those curves, except for the fact that you've got a folded over end, which is not a straight piece of wire. Those curves are done for a straight piece of wire. But every reasonable diameter that you're likely to use on a quarter wave ground plane is in that curve. So therefore, by looking at how far you can go away from the 90 degree point, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. The horizontal axis on those curves is degrees of wavelength of the radiating element. And the vertical axis is, in the case of the reactive curve, how much capacitive, which is down to negative numbers, and how much inductance, positive numbers, you're going to get. So those curves will allow you to figure out how fast the reactance is going to rise. As you stare at those curves, you'll see that for fatter and fatter radiators, the reactance rises much more slowly as you go away from resonance. So except for the curve you've got on the end, which is a poor man's top hat, so to speak, that curve will give you a fairly exact answer. And my gut feel is that if you double the diameter, you're going to get maybe 50% increase in the bandwidth. That's just a gut feel, but that curve is going to give you a more accurate answer, Eric. Here we go. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K2-R-I-Z. The tapping you're hearing is Eric at the website making improvements in the system. You got it, Joe. Wait for the beeps.
I need it for a second.
Oh, so when you tap, you need it. Okay. I'll know to stand by. You got it, Eric.
Okay, Dick, I gotta get my meter out of this.
Okay, I think you're saying we're back in full operation. Is that true, Eric?
Almost full operation. The people on EchoLink can hear, but they can't talk. We'll get to that at another time.
So I think you're saying we have normal linking in both directions to the 975-375 repeater. We have IRLP in operation, and EchoLink people will be able to hear, but they will not be able to talk. So that's where we stand right now, if I hear you correctly, Eric. KE2EJ for any fill, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K3, yeah, you got it right. That's where we're at, which is where we were.
Okay. Thank you. So, that's my preliminary answer, and I think the best answer you're going to get is from those curves, Joe. It's a very minor perturbation you're making by folding over the end. The majority of your bandwidth is coming from the diameter of the radiator, assuming it's a quarter wave ground plane with a good size of counterpoise on it. That's how those curves were made. And that's real measured data, which is a hell of a lot better than the equations you can plug the parameters into. Various people have come up with equations for what is the impedance of a dipole versus diameter, length, and so on. And the curves are better, more accurate, in my opinion, than the equation. And when you do read the caveats that go along with the equation, they tell you it's only true for a few percent above and below resonance. And yet people use those equations as if they work from DC to light, and they get themselves into a lot of trouble. W2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe. And how soon are you going to be making that experiment of changing the diameter?
Oh, probably tomorrow if the weather's good. I'll rig up my test setup again. See, the funny thing about the why I like this antenna is because it's DC grounded, so it gives you some sort of, apparent lightning nearby strike potential protection because the top element is actually DC grounded. And it would probably pop up if a low being used in different businesses and so forth. I've seen a few of them around over the years and so forth. But the funny thing is, the top element is always near quarter wavelength in length in inches. The radials are, and that's even something even a little odder. The radials are two radials of 3/8 inch aluminum rod, and the other two radials are almost 1/2 inch aluminum rod. And it was purposely made that way. I thought it was a mistake, but apparently that's the way these antennas are made. So two go in one way and two go in the other way, and so you got a slightly different diameter rod for the ground plane in one direction compared to another.
Is the radiating element a completely folded element coming all the way back down the ground? Is that what you're saying? It's DC grounded? In other words, you've got a folded dipole, but half of the folded dipole, so it's a folded monopole. So does that fold element come all the way back down the ground, Joe?
Yes, it does.
Okay, that gives it a lot more bandwidth, because now the apparent diameter is really a function of the spacing between the upgoing rod and the rod coming back down. So that's going to give you a lot more bandwidth than the curve, if you know what I mean. The RF energy is somewhat blind to whether or not the radiator is completely round or it's just made out of a piece of sheet metal that's got a certain width to it, and that's where you are. So when you look at the diameter of your rod and you calculate how many, what percentage of a wavelength is that diameter, and you go to the appropriate curve, I'm pretty sure you're going to find out that you're getting more bandwidth than the curve predicts. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
Okay, well, you said 50% is what you think. I may not leave this antenna permanently like that, but I mean, I just want to try it just to see actually in reality what it actually does. I don't know if I can actually leave it like that, but there's enough strength in the porcelain insulator which supports the top element, so I may be able to permanently leave it like that if I get the thing to work properly. But if I don't get a desired enough bandwidth where I can operate the thing down to say as low as about 50.1, 50.2, with the center frequency being 52 and a half or so, I won't leave the other element up there permanently. But I'll come back next week with some more test data for you. It's funny also, I did a couple of different points here, and it seems like it's a little lopsided with the bandwidth. Let's see.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And it's 54.36 is minus 10. But, let's see, what is minus 15? Minus 15 is 51.78 and 53.48. So you see, they're going away from the center frequency. It's a little lopsided as far as the resonance curve, but it looks very, the curve sort of almost looks symmetrical, but not quite. I'm not sure why it does that.
All every antenna is a little bit lopsided like that, Joe. As you go down in frequency, the capacitor reactance rises a little bit faster in the inductive reactance because you go above resonance. Now that I know you've got a folded monopole, where the fold comes all the way back down to ground, and the length is therefore a little bit less than a quarter wavelength, your apparent diameter is really the spacing between the upgoing rod and the downgoing rod. That's the apparent diameter. And therefore, the spacing between those two rods is what the RF energy sees. If you now take that folded dipole and make it out of thottle rod, twice the diameter rod, you're going to get only a very minor change in bandwidth, in my opinion. You'll soon find that out. But if you change the design so that the spacing between the upgoing rod and the downgoing rod was greater, there you would pick up more bandwidth, in my opinion. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
I hear the transmitter not quite as strong. I don't know what just happened to it. Does it seem like the same thing on your S meter as far as the forward, the downlink signal? My ear sounds a little like it changed in level. Okay, well, there's about a 2.5 inch distance between the center radiating element and where it folds, and when it folds over at the top and comes down to the ground plate. No, I can't change that spacing. It's mechanically made into the between the porcelain insulator and actual part on the ground plate itself where the ground rod goes into and you tell you what it says through. So that I can't change. What I was going to try was just simply another diameter tubing. I want to put alongside the other one and use like a pair of hose clamps on the top and bottom to just sort of increase the diameter of that main radiating element to begin with. I have a piece of pipe that's about the same diameter. I thought that might make a difference.
Okay, now, how are you going to attach this? I'm going to guess you've got a larger diameter pipe. You're going to lay it parallel to the upgoing radiator and attach it with hose clamps. By the way, is the whole folded monopole all the same diameter of tubing or rod, whichever it is? So, by the way, whether you split the tubing you're about to add and make it really symmetrical around that upgoing rod tubing, or just lay it alongside and connect it with hose clamps, that's not going to make very much difference. So there's 2.5 inches of spacing between the upgoing and the downgoing rod, and you're going to double the diameter, which I think you said is 3/8 of an inch, by putting another one in parallel. I don't think it's going to make much of a difference, Joe. A few percent is my opinion. Go ahead.
Okay, now on the next transmitter, just tell me if you notice that the forward signal from the repeater's down a little bit, because I'm getting a little bit of popping in my radio, like I'm not getting the same signal strength as before. Anyway, the top radiating element, as it leaves the porcelain insulator, is very close. It's either 5/8 or very close. It's between 5/8 and 3/4 inch diameter, and that's tubing. And that piece of tubing is comes to a certain point, and it has this metal rod welded to the top of it, and then the metal rod is bent over, and that comes down alongside it at about a 2.5 inch spacing, and then goes to the ground plate itself. So the radiating part of the element compared to the ground part of the element, or the top element, is not the same diameter. The rod is about 3/8 inch diameter like the ground plate radials, but the main radiating part is closer to 3/4 of an inch diameter tubing.
Yeah, if you did a very precise measurement to find out how much energy is radiated by the large diameter rod versus the small diameter rod that comes back down, you're going to find out they're almost identical. You think you're feeding the fat one, and you think the fat one is, and then the welded on narrow one that turns around and comes back down, you think that's only there for lightning protection, so to speak. At one instant of time, the top of that assembly has a high positive voltage compared to the ground plane. At the next half cycle, it's got a high negative voltage. So everything, all of your vertical metal is doing almost an equal amount of radiating. Therefore, you can get the biggest change by taking your fat rod and putting it in parallel with the narrow rod and holding it down with hose clamps. You're going to get a little bit more action when you do that. But you think the fat one's doing all the radiating and the skinny one is not. They're doing almost equal radiating, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW.
So you think if I actually take this other piece of tubing I have, which is made of, for right now, a piece of steel pipe I have. Very, very thin wall steel pipe. You think of my hose clamp back to the ground part of the top element instead of the actual top element itself. You think that would have more effect on the bandwidth?
That's what I'm saying, Joe.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to try this tomorrow morning. Have to set the thing up and try it with the radiator, increasing the radiator's effective diameter, and then I'll try it on the ground side. I'll jot all these numbers down, and I'll get back to you next week and let you know what I come up with, because it's an interesting antenna. Probably if somebody's very clever of it, they could probably build something like this on any band, because I have seen them commercially available for 2 meters and 440. But it's a nice antenna because of the DC potential. I'll keep the antenna in DC potential for nearby lightning strikes. Back to you.
Repeater, timeout.
What's the brand name of that antenna, Joe, and where did you get it? How long ago? Is it still being manufactured?
Yes, I have a Phelps Dodge model, but it was also made by Decibel Products. They made a very similar looking antenna. I believe what I have is called a PD501. And I don't recall what Decibel Products, what their type number is, but it looks very similar in construction. But it's a very old antenna. It goes back to probably about the 50s as far as the design. As I said, I've seen them on different low band installations, like fuel companies, things like that, that typically use a lot of low band equipment, 42 to 50 type of thing. I've seen plenty of them around in my years of traveling. So it was very popular antenna. And it wasn't cheap either. It was a couple hundred dollars, I guess, they got for this thing in its day. Don't know if they make it anymore.
What's the height of that thing, Joe? The actual the length of the radiator from the ground plane to the tip of the top. Is it close to 4 feet?
Yeah, it is very close to about 4 feet or so. And I think a quarter wave on 6 meters is like 51, 52, 53 inches, something like that, if I remember. So that's why I said it doesn't follow the same routine in construction as you do with a simple open element antenna, like, because I had an open element ground plane antenna for 52 and a half megahertz many, many years ago, set up in one installation I had. And the top element in that case was similar to the ground plane radials, which were bent down at about a 45 degree angle. These ground plane radials go out at 90 degrees. Or actually, there's a 90 degree difference between the top element and the ground plane radials. They're not bent down to 40 degrees at all. They come out straight off the plate.
Very nice. I'm guessing there is no impedance matching device at the base. In other words, your input connector goes straight to that radiating large diameter rod. Is that true?
Yes, to about a 2.5, maybe 3 foot piece of, I think it's RTA that has an end connector, an end male connector at the end of it that you attach to your transmission line, but you can't see the inside of it, how it attaches, what's inside. But it's a solid DC connection, no capacitor in series at all that I can do, because you can ohmmeter it out and look at the DC potential effect when you put it across the transmission lines. It appears like a DC short.
Okay, that'll be an interesting experiment. So we'll see next week when you connect your parallel piece of pipe with hose clamps. You're going to get a slight dip in impedance. In other words, you've developed a little bit of ISWR at your resonant frequency. The resonant frequency is going to shift a little bit, but the bandwidth will increase slightly, and I think you're going to get more increase in bandwidth when you put it on the narrow rod, the one that goes down to the ground plane. We'll soon find out. George is next. KD2FIU, with an antenna question. K2LAW, go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. Another antenna question. But this is about vertical ground-mounted antennas. And let me get rid of the other side there. Vertical ground-mounted antennas and conductivity of the alternate phase between the radiator and the alternate phase, or at that point it's not ground planes, ground radials. Ground radials versus excellent and non-good ground conductivity beneath it. Let me let it drop and I'll set this up. a understanding a lot of different formulas for numbers of ground radials with different bands, numbers of ground radials for multi-freq versus, middle frequency versus high frequency. Let's say I'm working with the best conductivity that I understand, which would be salt water. From there, water, or just plain good soil as far as I can see. I've got a vertical monopole, multipole, trapped, inductor, collinear, or whatever. I got a vertical sitting there, and I'm going right into good ground. And if I'm going right into good ground, I'm looking at good ground, good near field conductivity. Let me let it drop again. Okay, if I don't have good near field conductivity for the opposing phase of the antenna, I'm going to go with ground radials. Many formulas for ground radials versus the conductivity on the ground below you. My question is, if I have excellent ground conductivity beneath me and I don't use radials, and let's say it's excellent earth and going towards the best, salt water, and between that and salt water, let's go up the scale with there, and I'm not using radials, do I have a benefit if I'm using radials in the excellent to salt water, super excellent alternate phase conductivity?
Yeah, I think I see where you're going here, George. This is the best of all worlds. You'd have a very large sheet of flat metal laying on the ground, and your vertical radiator would be suspended on an insulator in the middle of it, and it would now be the ideal situation, similar to a half-wave dipole. In the case of a half-wave dipole in free space, you can put a sheet of metal at right angles to the wire, directly in the center of the dipole. And because that's the neutral plane, at one instant of time, the right-hand side of the dipole is positive, left-hand side is negative, on the next half cycle they're reversed, but that sheet of metal that I've just described is on the neutral plane. Putting that sheet of metal there changes nothing on the impedance, the pattern, the gain, the efficiency, everything stays the same. And somebody a long time ago realized that, yes, a dipole antenna is a pair of ground planes back-to-back with a sheet metal in the middle. And with that piece of sheet metal being there, you can throw away one half of the dipole and just feed it with reference to the ground plane. If you lay enough ground plane radials on the ground, like 32 of them, doesn't matter what diameter, doesn't matter if they're buried or not, the RF energy, the wavelength spacing between each of the ground plane radials is such a small fraction of a wavelength, the RF energy thinks that's a common, that's a flat sheet of metal. Your eye sees dirt in between the ground plane radials. The RF energy doesn't see that. Let me drop. As you start going to a lower and lower number of ground plane radials, the RF energy starts seeing the dirt in between the ground plane radials. And now the conductivity of that dirt starts making a difference. The dirt is a volumetric, lossy material. And seawater, as good as it is nowhere near as good as a sheet of copper. You'd like to believe you can just have one single rod going a few inches into the seawater, and that would be the counterpoise. It's not that good. Seawater is good compared to dirt, but it's not that good. So you could slowly change the conductivity of your soil with a small number of ground plane radials. As your soil becomes more and more resistive, as it starts moving toward the desert sand, so to speak, you start getting some more loss at first, and later on it's not loss. In other words, if you went over to pure desert sand in between a small number of ground plane radials, the desert sand is not a lossy material. It's almost a ground plane antenna with a small number of radials out in free space, if you know what I mean. So you'd have to tune the antenna slightly differently, but it could be very efficient. So you can lose some efficiency when the RF energy starts seeing the dirt and the dirt starts absorbing the RF energy. And if you're if your vertical antenna with a small number of ground plane radials is sitting in seawater, yes, the seawater is a lot more conductive. Yes, you'll get a lot less loss. So I suspect there's been a number of analyses and actual experiments. Let me drop. Where people have built a vertical ground plane antenna with two, three, or four ground plane radials, a number that's too small, and they tried it on different kinds of soil and over seawater. So you slowly slide from a perfect system with a large number of radials to an imperfect system with a small number of radials and lossy soil toward almost a station master antenna. Your station master antenna has three little stubby ground plane radials, but it's up in space. There's no lossy materials around. So once you've done a proper tuning job, the antenna can run at 100% efficiency. You can see how you slowly slide from one to the other. And the tilting of the ground plane radials does give you a way of adjusting the impedance of the center frequency of the vertical ground plane antenna. I know I haven't given you an exact answer, but I think I've given you a trend of how it slowly slides from one phenomena to the other. So seawater is better. But the best of all worlds, George, would be if the radiator is a half wavelength long. Let me drop. A quarter wavelength radiator over a perfect sheet of metal will have an input impedance of something like 72 ohms over 2, 36 ohms. It's going to have a 36 ohm impedance. And therefore, your counterpoise, what RF impedance does your counterpoise present compared to 36 ohms is what counts. If you've got a very small number of ground plane radials and the RF energy starts seeing a lot of the lossy dirt in between the ground plane radials, and if that ground plane had an apparent impedance of 36 ohms, of all your RF energy going into that antenna, half of it's going into the ground plane, half of it's going into the radiator, and you'd probably have something like 50% efficiency. An awful lot of it would be dissipated. In the case of a vertical antenna that's half wavelength long, the input impedance of a half wavelength long antenna is something closer to 2,000 ohms. Now, the impedance of your ground plane compared to 2,000 ohms is what counts. A simple spike in the ground, into lossy ground, is going to have an impedance, let me pick a number, of 70 ohms compared to the 2,000 ohms of the antenna. 90-some-odd% of the energy goes into the antenna, and very little of it goes into the ground. So if you can make the radiator electrically a half wavelength long, and you feed the outer end of it where it has high impedance, now the conductivity and resistivity, so to speak, the lossiness of your counterpoise starts becoming irrelevant. That gives you one of the ideas of why a half-wave vertical radiator can be extremely efficient, even though you're mounting it over very lossy soil with an inadequate number of ground plane radials. So if you start doing experiments of doing various things to make your vertical radiator electronically a half wavelength long as a resonator.
Repeater, timeout.
You'll have to do some impedance matching, because now you're feeding a 2,000 ohm impedance instead of 36 ohm impedance. But that's a very simple LC network, if you know what I mean. Over to you, George. KD2 FIU, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, this is very helpful, the way you explained it, because you explained it empirically where I can experiment with it. The fact is that the conductivity, which is of the counterpoise system, is tunable. It's tunable, and I have a cross point where it becomes lossy versus being closer to the tuning of the vertical pole itself. Is that correct?
Yes, I think you've got the concept, George. Your counterpoise, if you look at the center of your counterpoise and by some magic means measure its RF impedance, the resistive component and the reactive component, it's a function of how many ground plane radials and how lossy is the soil. the RF impedance of your counterpoise would be perfect if it was a great big sheet of metal. It would be very close to zero ohms. And as you use a decreasing number of ground plane radials mounted over lossy soil, the RF impedance of your counterpoise starts going up. The worst case situation is where it's around 37 ohms. Now half your energy is going into the radio, half of the energy is going into the counterpoise. And you'll be heating up the soil. So it's not an easy measurement to make. How do you measure the impedance of your counterpoise? And I can think of various techniques of doing it. One of them would be to know how much current, your RF current, you're pumping into the antenna. Let me drop the... And by doing a whole bunch of field measurements around the antenna, you find out how much energy is being radiated, and you know that all the energy you're pumping into the antenna, if you're pumping 100 watts into the antenna, and you make a whole bunch of field measurements, and you can account for 70 watts being radiated. Therefore, you know 30 watts didn't get radiated. Therefore, that 30 watts probably went into the soil. Not an easy measurement to make. But what it's all dependent on is... what is the real RF impedance of your counterpoise system compared to the feed impedance of your radiator? And you can pick up this huge advantage. If your radiator is a half wavelength long and you're feeding the outer end of it, where it approaches 2,000 ohms of resistive component, now the yuckiest counterpoise in the world would be very adequate. So a person doing a field experiment, because he's setting up a field, you know, doing a field day and it doesn't want to spend a whole lot of time laying down 64 radials. So he makes the vertical radiator. Let me drop the... He makes it a half wavelength long, assuming he's got a tree nearby that's tall enough so he can do that on 80 meters. And he feeds the outer impedance with it, with an LC network that steps up the impedance from 50 ohms to the 2,000. Now his counterpoise could be a simple spike in the ground, and that antenna might have 97% efficiency. Because he's feeding such a high impedance of the radiator. KD2FIU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, excellent. I'm getting the concept here, and I'm also coming in on the fact that, once again, I'm going to be looking at impedance and reflected energy as my rule. That I can probably get around this with experimentation based on any soil that I want to mount a ground-mounted vertical. If I'm following the rule, which is going to be reflected and impedance, and the fact is that the vertical itself can be matched with the simplest meat at one point, the simplest counterpoise at one point, by different lengths of spikes. Start with that. So at this point, since it's so variable as to what the conductivity of the soil is around us, and let's say none of us live on the ocean, but let me let it drop. Different experiments with different lengths of rods can tell me which way I'm going with this. Different experiments with different lengths of wires, not necessarily resonant wires, can tell me what I'm doing with this soil as a conductor or an alternate a counterpoise, alternate phase counterpoise for the vertical. So I got an idea. I got a good idea on how to measure and some of the experimental measures I may take to do it. Thanks for entertaining this, Dick.
I'm kind of curious, George. Do you intend to actually start running a series of experiments? Or are you going to be plugging different numbers into a computer modeling program and studying it that way and plug in the numbers for what are typical soils? Wonder what you intend to do with this. But... there's a double and triple advantage of making the vertical radiator one half wavelength long. You're feeding a very high impedance. You're no longer very dependent on the quality of the ground plane counterpoise system. Almost not dependent at all. On top of that, the phase center of the antenna is higher above the Earth. Another mechanism by which you get more signal on the horizon, the lower angle of radiation, and so on. So you pick up a double or a triple advantage if you make that half, if you make that radiator a half wavelength long electronically. Over to you, George. K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yes, I understand that. That's the advantage of the collinear phasing. I can picture it. I can picture it as the electrons are traveling each direction and reversing, and going in each direction and the other way and reversing in the collinear phasing. I think that's what you're going with, Dick. Is that correct?
Yes. And even though the right-hand side of the dipole is positive and the left-hand side is negative at this instant of time, intuitively it sounds like they're out of phase with each other. The current is flowing in the same direction in both halves. The current is what makes the magnetic field. The magnetic field, arguably, is the first step of the radiation. So on that full half-wave dipole, those two sides are two collinear elements in phase with each other current-wise, and therefore whatever radiation they both do adds up in space. So you end up with a much narrower, a much lower elevation angle of beam width with a half-wave radiator versus a quarter-wave radiator under normal conditions. Higher phase center above the ground, less dependence on the ground plane quality, the counterpoise quality, and you have two vertical polarized collinear elements in phase with each other when you do that. It's hard, kind of hard to believe that when you make the radiator, let me drop it. You make that vertical radiator one half wavelength long electronically, even though there is no insulator in the center of it, as if it was an ordinary dipole. Doesn't matter. There are two collinear elements there, even though it looks like one straight piece of wire. KD2FIU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. I'm glad you brought up the half wave versus the quarter wave. That's important because I've always understood the benefit of the half wave, even in a single element, as you mentioned, and the way the wave travels through it. What I got out of this that I really appreciated is the rule that I will be measuring when I want to build counterpoise against different conductivity of soil below a vertical. Well, I do understand. I do understand that the half wave is going to eliminate a lot of the dependency of that, but I also understand how I'm going to measure if I have to be stuck with quarter wave. Is that it? KD2FIU.
Yeah, there's a little additional piece of magic here. In the best of all worlds, your quarter wave on 80 meters would be a vertical rod that's 67 feet tall, and a half wave would be a vertical rod that's 132 feet tall on 80 meters. You could make that vertical rod 67 feet tall, and by having loading coils, top hat capacitors, zigzagging, by various techniques, that 67 foot long radiator, you can make it act electronically one half wavelength long. You can make it into a half wave long electronic resonator, even though it physically is only a quarter wave long. You have the resources to do that. And when you feed the outer edge, because you've got it shrunk in size, I'm not quite sure the 2,000 ohm impedance I'm using as a number of the resistive component where you're feeding it at the outer end. Would it be a little bit higher, a little bit lower? Not easy to say, but it's got to be something in the vicinity of 2,000 ohms. You can create a half wavelength long radiator, even though it's physically only a quarter wavelength long. And you'll pick up most of these benefits when you do that, George. Your vertical beam width, well, it's going to be a little bit broader because it's physically shorter. But when it comes to the impedance dependence on the quality of your counterpoise, you'll pick up that advantage. KD2FIU, K2RIW.
Yeah, Very good point that you brought up there, because you just brought in what I've always supported, is that the difference between the loading inductor and a trap. All right, and maybe 5 or 6 months ago, I was on here talking about how I took the 40-meter dipole and built 120 microhenry loading coils and put them at the end of the 40-meter dipole, and actually was able to bring it to the next wave, which was in the 80-75-meter band. And at the same time, although you have a narrowness in bandwidth, it does work. So you did a very, you did a reminder. You remind me of the fact that the inductor itself can make the radiator, the quarter wave radiator, look and resonate as a half wave radiator, as in the case of 40-75-80. If you tune the tip, you got 75. If you tune the tip, you got 80. So that's very, very important here. I don't have to have the length to get that half wave vertical dipole in the air. If I can build it with an inductor, whether it's an 80, 100, 120, 140, whatever, Mike, let me let it drop. Whatever the inductor is, the fact is I can make it resonate at that point, and then I'm working with tuning the resonance of the counterpoise against the conductivity that I'm mounting it on. So, very good. A lot of information here, Dick. KD2FRU. Thank you.
Yeah, the wording you're using right now, George, leads me to believe that you believe that only a loading coil will bring your physically shortened radiator down to that lower frequency. You've got a whole lot of ways of doing it. You can take something that is... You're building an antenna for the 75 or 80-meter handband, and you're not going to make it a... You want it electronically to be a half wavelength long, which would ordinarily be 132 feet, but you've only got 67 feet to work with. You can now make it a helically wound radiator, helical wound for the hold on length if you want to, a loading coil at the bottom, top, loading coil at the middle, combinations of helical winding and loading coils, zigzagging it, bending the ends, top hat capacitors, bottom capacitors, and so on. When it comes to techniques for making the electronic resonance go down in frequency without changing the physical length tip to tip, you got a whole lot of techniques. Helical winding, loading coils, zigzagging, top hat capacitors, all kinds of combinations. So methods of moving it down in frequency and keeping it a half wave resonant when it's physically too short, you got a number of ways of doing it. They all will have equal efficiency if you use low-loss materials. Over to you for any further comments on all of that, George. Over to you, K2RIW.
Yeah, I did forget about capacitive top hat horizontal radial planes. I did forget about that. Thank you.
And helical winding. The hold-on length could be one great big helix, if you know what I mean. All of these will give you additional electrical length without physical length. So, good luck with all those experiments. Let us know how it goes. Next guy on our list was Rich, N2EO. N2 Echo Oscar, the former WB2 Tango Charlie Charlie. K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. The other call goes back many, many years. I think it was about 1970 that I got the extra interchange. Anyway, I hope my question is simple. It's a computer question. I know it's not for computer net, but maybe Eric is there. or somebody else knowledgeable. Let me reset. Right, I'm having trouble with a brand new Microsoft 10 computer. I'm trying to reformat and restart and put it back to factory standard, because I'm having a lot of trouble with things. I know I'll lose files, I really don't care. There's not much on it, but it's saying the hard drive is full. Don't understand. So I checked around, I did a lot. I think the best thing if I can is to put it back to factory, but I don't know how to do it. Are there keyboard commands to do that? N2EO.
If I understand you correctly, Rich, you've got a fairly new computer, new to you, and you're getting an error message that the hard drive is full. And you know darn well it's not, because you haven't mounted that much on it. So you'd like to wipe it clean and start from fresh. I'm going to send it back to you for corrections on all of that. And you're going to tell us one more time the brand name and model number and how long you've had it and what its former history is. Is it something you bought new or something you bought used? Is it a previously owned computer where somebody has who knows what on there that you don't yet know about? N2EO, K2LIW, Redridge.
Brand new Hewlett-Packard laptop. Brand new. What I'm trying, in the older laptops that still had Windows 10, remember I had one that spilled coffee in it. That was the end of that, so I bought this one. In that computer, I remember they had the drive formatted. And you could go in there and wipe it clean if you had to, and reformat the drive and reinstall Windows. This one doesn't have that. There's no formatting on the C drive. Don't know what I can find, and I don't know what to do.
AC2GS.
Go right ahead, Roy.
Okay, once again, I just want to use a phrase that's very helpful. Google is friend. If you Googled it, they give you very concise instructions. You go to the little icon in the lower left-hand corner. You select settings. You select update and security when you're in settings. You then click the recovery in the left pane, and it says click get started under reset this PC. Then you click either keep my files or remove everything, depending upon what you want, and you should reset your Windows 10 PC to your factory level.
Thank you, Roy. I'm going to try it right now. What do I click? Click it first.
Yeah, you go down to the menu portion and you look for the settings list, and you bring up the settings window, and from there you go to the update and security window.
Oh, I don't see a settings menu. I mostly work with an Apple, so I don't really know much about Microsoft.
You know the little start menu or whatever it's called in Windows 10? It's on the lower left-hand side. It's the first little image. You click it open and you get a bunch of window panes of stuff. And one of the things amongst all that stuff is the word settings.
Okay, I just brought it up. In those window panes, it'll say settings.
One of the selections is settings.
Okay. Well, go try it. Go on to the next person. If I need further help, I'll come back. N2EO. Thank you.
Okay, good luck with that, Rich. Those are all the people who signed in who said they had a question. Did I skip anybody who said they had a question? KQRIW and the TechNet listening. Okay, I didn't think so. Alrighty, we're going to go over to our next section on the menu, which is the famous science and physics section. And you're about to hear science and physics report number 19. I finally counted them up, Roy. Way back in October 8th is when you officially signed on with a real website for the mailbag and so on. And so this is science and physics report number 19. The floor is yours, Rich. I mean, Roy, and you can choose any subject you like, or the ones that have been suggested to you over the last week. Alpha Charlie 2, Golf Sierra, Dr. Roy, K2RIZ. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS with the science talk or the physics talk or whatever else you want to call the talk. Let me just do some basic stuff. Keep in mind that if you need to contact me, you could either use the good old email address of mailbag@limarktech.net, or if you want to do it simple, you can make it simple by just typing in roy@ac2gs.com, because that's my call sign, ac2gs, and .com is my domain. So if you need to contact me, if you have any kind of questions, if you want topics discussed, feel free to send me all and above. Let me drop. I thought what we might do is kind of clean up some little misconceptions and not fully explain things from last week. We were talking about oxygen and nitrogen and how you concentrate them and such, and it was my thought off the top of my head that electrolysis of water seems to be the easiest, cleanest way of doing it. And in spaceships and rocket ships and submarines and some airplanes, that is exactly what they do. But in industrial surroundings where air is very cheap and electricity is relatively expensive, they simply extract the oxygen out of and the nitrogen out of the room air. And they do it by a number of ways. Oxygen concentrators that individual people tend to use a lot use something that's called a diaphragm, although to me it's not really that much of a diaphragm. It's more of capillaries. It's hollow tubes that allow nitrogen to flow through them, but cause oxygen to kind of percolate out the sides, and then you recollect it on the sides and pump it into your mask, and you have oxygen concentration. Let me drop.
Hey, dude, Dad, for a moment.
You got it, Eric.
Yeah, I'm not in a place where I can hear very well. Can you tell me if the hum's gone?
I'm listening to the output of the repeater. I'm not hearing a hum. If you want, I'll listen on 375 also. Go ahead.
Yeah, the problem was strictly with Moto, so if you don't hear it, it's gone. Thanks.
I'm not hearing a hum. Was somebody earlier reporting a hum, Eric?
The repeater's been humming for the last 2.5 weeks because of some ground loop connectivity.
Okay, I'm wearing earphones, and I'm not hearing a hum. So when you say hum, you mean 120 hertz?
60 or 120. It was there. I mean, it wasn't that loud, but it was loud enough.
Okay, I'm hearing the PL tone. I'm hearing your voice. Everything sounds great to me. It's hi-fi right now. So, Roy, I've seen people with a machine that's plugged into a 110-volt line. The machine is about a foot and a half wide, high, maybe 2 feet deep. Looks like it weighs about 40 pounds. And they keep it plugged in with a long extension cord, and they go walking around the house with this thing that gives them excess oxygen that they're breathing. Is that that's kind of a diaphragm with some kind of an air pump inside? Is that how that's working up, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW in the TechNet.
Well, they call it a diaphragm, but for some odd reason, or a membrane, I really don't like the nomenclature that much. I mean, the compressor probably is a diaphragm. But the actual action looks visibly like a lot of, say, capillary tubes. They're hollowed out rods, and they preferentially allow nitrogen to flow through the center.